I'm really lousy with dates. And there are a couple that I remember in particular, partly because I've learned over the years how much it matters to remember them. I did manage to convince my wife that we should get married on Remembrance Day, which I found enormously helpful over the years. I've also learned that the middle, in my brain, because numbers are concepts to me, not details, just because that's kind of the brain I've gotten. And so the concept of the middle of the month is the 15th. And I know that's not mathematically always correct, but in my brain, it's always correct. That's the middle of the month. And my wife's birthday is in the middle of the month. So all I actually have to remember now is the month. See, and I can usually do that. So, and this morning, I can. Just in case you're wondering, it's September. I know. And there's a record of it, if you're listening to this podcast here. There's lots of days I remember, though, even though I can't remember the dates for them. That's more the way it works for me. I remember the pictures. I remember the places. And when I go to those places physically again, things kind of flood back in lots of times. And I have a very particular memory of sitting in Finale's at the corner of, just over the bridge by Marion there, with a good friend, priest from St. Benedict's Table, Jamie House, and somebody we've kind of walked through a few things together over the years, Jamie and I. And I remember sitting in Finale's with Jamie when I was in transition between the ministry that I was a part of before I came to the Table and coming to this community, and wrestling out loud with what some of the options were. And I'd spent a fairly serious chunk of time in that transition in self-assessment at a level that I hadn't really done regarding my work before. This felt like one of those transitions that I needed to, for whatever set of reasons, I needed to take this very, very seriously and do deeper work than I had done in previous transitions. And so I made a commitment to that and done my best in it. And I remember sitting with Jamie in that restaurant and telling him about this community and having something just kind of well up inside of me that said, I want this. And I was able to articulate that. I couldn't name all the variables in it, but it was just like something just went off inside of me. And I said that to Jamie. I said, I want this. There aren't very many hills that I die on. My view of the world isn't the sort of view that suggests that all sorts of things are ultimate either-ors. I think if you've been in this community for a while, you know that. But this really felt like one of those kind of moments where, when I was honest with my soul and my life, I just knew. I had a not dissimilar pair of experiences this week. Sort of a passion testing pair of experiences. One was a finance task force meeting. Those can be testing at all sorts of levels, depending on the content. This was a fantastic time with this team. It just came away absolutely reinvigorated by being with a portion of our leadership team and listening to them talk with just ordinary honesty about their passion for this community and its wellness and its future. And I said to that team at that meeting, you're acting like leaders. And I love this. That just knocked me out. We've been headed that way, and I think we're getting there in ways that just make me really excited for our future. I was out of town yesterday, and on the drive, had a couple of moments to sort of catch up on my voicemail, and one of the voicemails that I got yesterday morning was from Abby, who is the owner of the Exchange Cafe, letting me know that the new owners take possession on May the 18th. And they're not interested in having us be a part of their plan. Well, those are the kind of moments that can be challenging as well, right? You know, we knew that one of the things that we're poking around in is the possibility of a move to a new venue. We didn't have a timeline, And if we'd made one up, this probably wouldn't have been it. But now we do have a timeline. And again, sort of a little gut check, a little self-check. What's the passion like? How do I feel about this phone call? How do I feel about this information? Abby, for what it's worth, was very apologetic about the timeline and even offered to help us carry things out of the basement, which I think was really sweet. And what I got back from that check-in was that same sense that I had sitting with Jamie, that same sense that I had sitting with the finance team. Just undiminished passion and hope for what this community could be. Just settle somewhere in there. It's, you know, I don't know what that means, but I know it's there. And for me, that has kind of led me on a little deeper, I suppose, on a quest that I was already on, that team meeting had put some turbos on for me as well. And that's back into this set of questions for myself as a pastor and as a part of a leadership team. Why do I think a community like the table is so important? What do I think we can do? What do I think we can offer as a community at this point in our lives that's both unique and that's deeply needful? That's a meaningful engagement with the hurts and the hungers and the celebrations and the trends of the present in this day, in this culture, both inside and outside of Christendom. What do we have to offer? Well, there's lots of ways to come at a question like that. And what I want to do this morning is suggest two possible perspectives on that. They grow out of both experience and reflection, and I hope they'll be helpful to us. I hope they'll be encouraging to us. One of the things that I think a community like this one can offer that is very, very significant, both in the broader culture and in the unique kind of subculture of spiritual questing, and even if we're going to nicheify it even more, in the subculture of questing that falls under the banner of, somehow under the banner of Christendom, I think one of the things that this community exists to provide in all of that is a safe place for big questions and big shifts. And that's the age we live in, around faith, around spirituality, I think in the culture in general. Man, stuff is changing. And stuff is going to change, and we know it. We know we live in an age where, as one leadership book in the last decade said in its title, that somebody moved the cheese. The title was Who Moved the Cheese? Which I think is a brilliant book title for a business leadership book. But that the targets are mobile. The things are changing in our age. And they're changing in ways that can create tremendous sense of fear. I think we live in a culture with pervasive fears and anxieties. But it can also create a tremendous opportunity. It can also create, and I know it's a cliche, you know, I know there's an ancient Chinese symbol that's for trouble. It's kind of this combination of things. But like a lot of cliches, it comes from somewhere. I think it comes from somewhere deeply true. When we live in a world of change, how are we going to respond? How are we going to live in that world? When we live in a world of theological change, how will we respond? When we live in a world of financial change, how are we going to respond? When we live in a world where, when it comes to success, somebody moved the cheese. When it comes to ownership or comfort, security as it's been construed by the now retiring boomers, how are we going to live in that world? Big shifts. And I am constantly, it feels like, having conversations with people that remind me how much fear there is, especially, partly because I'm a pastor, I'm a Christian pastor. You know, that's my vocation and my occupation. And partly because of all of that and my own history in that, in this community, in the Winnipeg area, I get to have these conversations in this realm with people. And I keep having conversations with people where what I walk away with, if I kind of went, what's the aftertaste in my mouth and in my soul from this conversation, it's that tangy iron flavor of residual fear. The response in a lot of those conversations to shift, to change, is not fear. That's not the visible response. The visible response is combativeness. The visible response is often something like anger. Davis, my oldest son, says to me the other day, he says, "Dad, do you know what a fundamentalist is?" I said, "What?" He said, "It's an evangelical that's angry." You grew up evangelical, that'll mean something to you if you didn't, let it go. In fact, if you did grow up evangelical, it'd be good to let it go too. I just thought that was kind of insightful and sad and funny all at the same time. Big shifts, and they create enormous fear. And one of the reasons they create so much fear, especially in Christian faith and belief, and in those realms, I think, is because so many people that have grown up sort of at the zenith of modern Christianity have grown up with what I would call a hegemonic idea of belief. This idea that there's one set of codes that define what is true and right and good. And if you're inside that set of codes, whether they're belief codes or behavior codes, lifestyle codes, worship codes, there's a whole collection. But if you're inside that circle, you are inside the realm of what is called true, good, right, authored by God. We can keep going. The point is that circle of belief contains, in so many of our lived experiences, the only possible way to be a Christian. And when that's assailed at any point, because it's hegemonic, because it's a closed circle that is meant to be unassailable, that's the way the whole system works. It's like if that's an awkward picture for you and you prefer games, think of it as a tower of Jenga blocks. Pull one out, what happens? Right? Whoa, you know, you pull a few out, the whole thing, and that's the danger. The whole thing's going to collapse if you pull on any of the pieces. With that kind of a system of belief, anything that assails that system, assails any part of that system, assails the whole system. And if that's the way you frame your belief, anything that pokes at it creates the fear that the whole thing is invalid. That's sort of a simple way, maybe, of even, I was going to say characterizing, which was being too generous with myself, even caricaturing a certain system of belief. Had a conversation 2 days ago. It was sort of laid out to be an hour, and it took half a day, you know. One of those conversations that smart, thoughtful person really wrestling with their faith. And saying, you know, I keep bumping into things that make my mind say, I don't believe anymore. But when I try not to believe with my mind, I realize that my whole being believes. Made me cry. Man, I just thought that is such a lovely picture of what it means to be a person of faith. Sometimes my brain wants to stop believing. Sometimes my brain just feels like, I cannot reconcile this issue. I cannot reconcile this change that's coming at me. I cannot reconcile the way that I was taught to believe with the world that I live in and the things that I'm facing and dealing with. I can't reconcile this framework for what's right and what's wrong with things that are in my own body, in my own life. So I guess I don't believe anymore. But when I try to do that, there's all these other things that comprise the self that rise up and say, but you do, and you know it. In the center of whatever the thing is that we call the self, you know it. And when you deny it, you know you're denying something essential about yourself. So now what? Now what is we go on a quest? Now what is we go exploring? Now what is we screw our courage to the sticking point and wade on in there? And to do that, we need a safe place. To do that, we need a community that says, we are committed to being faithful followers of Jesus in the same breath that we know it doesn't look, sound, feel like it did. We know that the cultural framework for belief is not the one that we might have been trained under, the one that we may have, in my case, grown up at what I believe was the zenith of. But somehow our whole self still believes. And we've got this work to do. We've got these questions. We've got these things to have at that frighten us or frighten those around us. Sometimes we get to a place where we feel like someone's reconciled and we're having a perfectly normal conversation with somebody else that's also a follower of Jesus, and they say something and we realize, you just made an assumption that I don't share, and it's enormous. Now what do I do? Because I love you. You're my friend. I care about this relationship. That's not uncomplicated. Those moments are difficult. We can walk away from those moments feeling like we brought our best to it and just shattered something that was dear to us. And we need somewhere to go. We need a community that can say, yeah, me too, about those moments, and walk together with us. And I think that the table has a unique opportunity to be that kind of a community at this time. I realize that I've been framing this idea largely in what could be understood to be negative terms, terms of conflict, of fear, of questioning. I don't think questioning is a negative, but having questions without answers can feel negative. That's uncertainty, and that can be alarming and challenging. There's another whole side to this. And the other whole side to this is kind of what we've been digging around in this big story series that we've been in. And this idea that right from the beginning of the biblical story, right from the beginning of this narrative that is so essential to our faith, we have a picture of a cooperative God, of a God that invites humans into the story, not just to tend the machinery that they've already put in place and set in motion. So in contrast to this Egyptian God we were talking about the other day, who had everything made before the humans came in, the irrigation channels were running, and now they just needed humans to build their infrastructure. Very different story that's at the roots of the thing that we now call Christendom or Christianity. And at the very beginning of this story, God invites us in. And God invites us into this world that our narrative says is made by a good God and is made good and very good. And so when we're invited into that story, we're invited into it to draw out, to constantly nurture, to constantly bring forth the very best of what is in this beautiful, good, and very good world that God has made. And at the pinnacle of that story, in terms of the good things God makes, is all of us. And is not just each of us, that's what our culture would in some ways affirm more readily, that each individual is that. But the picture as we have it, as Christianity takes the story from it, is a picture that what is very good about that is that it is an us, not an I. That it is communal, not aggressively individual and individualistic. There's a text, a First Testament text that I have just always loved, that I think kind of fleshes this picture out a little bit. Zephaniah. There's one I... Y'all keep going back to, don't you? Just got to read Zephaniah again. I know, I have to look it up in the index to find the page number every time. And I love this verse, and I still have to look it up. It's you know, about there. Well, Zephaniah kind of has what you'd maybe expect in terms of the language of God's judgment from this point of the sort of human unfolding understanding of the nature of God. God is threatening to, you know, wipe out the bad guys. And there's some of that judgment language and so on. But, and I think, again, this is sort of appropriate to where the text falls in the unfolding understanding of God in Scripture. We come toward the end of the book to this section. It starts in chapter 3, verse 14. Sing, O daughter of Zion, shout aloud, O Israel. Be glad and rejoice with all your heart, O daughter of Jerusalem. The Lord has taken away your punishment. He has turned back your enemy. The Lord, the King of Israel, is with you. Never again will you fear any harm. On that day, they will say, in Jerusalem, and if you've read the rest of Zephaniah, in that beleaguered Jerusalem. On that day, they will say to Jerusalem, do not fear, O Zion. Do not let your hands hang limp. The Lord your God is with you. He is mighty to save. He will take, listen to the language of this, He will take great delight in you. He will quiet you with His love. He will rejoice over you with singing. Ever been sung over that you can remember? Probably most of us, if we've been sung over, it happened at a part of our life that we have no conscious memories of when we were wee ones. I've had the pleasure of knowing that experience as an adult. Now maybe some of you have too. That is a powerful, powerful image. For someone to sing over me and over you is to make themselves tender to us, to make themselves vulnerable to us, to offer a kind of tender nurturance that I think all of our hearts absolutely crave, but very few of our hearts are able to believe might be possible. And we have all sorts of reasons for that dilemma. Some of them are our own, we've made them, some of them we've inherited, some of them come with the nature of the world in which we live. That's hard to believe. Which is partly why I think it's so significant that it's part of our sacred text, that God sees fit to offer us this image of God's self singing over us with love and with delight. And what happens in this story when God sings over us? What happens is that the writer reminds us that it's that kind of care that helps us not just stand there like a victim. Don't let your hands hang limp. That's what that's a picture of. Don't just let the, you know, I don't know, can't, won't, don't hit me. You know, just waiting for the train to come. Help us. We are not. We need not be. Why? Because among other things, God, in all of God's power, chooses to sing over us with love and with delight. How awesome is that? How wondrous is that? That is a safe place. If that's true of God, that God would behave like that, with all that God has made, including you and I. Wow. That's part of what is bundled up for us, you guys, in this opening ritual that Jason did such a great job of reminding us about this morning. Bidden or unbidden, God is present. Miles does not ask in any verbal, articulate way to be held, to be sung over. He asks for it just by his presence. Who can resist? Don't ignore these pictures in our midst, you guys. Don't ignore them. They are what Zephaniah is writing about, among other things. It's not coincidental that we are understood in Christendom's sacred story as the children of God, and as the children of a good, caring, nurturing God. It's not ridiculous at all to imagine God singing over us. And we don't even have to ask. We just have to be. And I think it's fair to say, God can't resist. If we're the overflow of the passionate love that God has with God, which is my favorite understanding of what it means to be a human being, then why wouldn't God sing over us? Because we grew up and screwed up? Well, God knows that might be true too. But if you've ever loved anybody that screwed up, you know that that doesn't necessarily make love go away. It might make it a little more complex. But it doesn't take away the impulse to love. If the table could be the kind of community that could make a safe place for those kind of big questions and big shifts, the kind of place where what we experience when we gather is this pervasive sense that we are together in the presence of a God who is like Zephaniah just described with us, I think we would be bringing the best sort of gift to the world that I could imagine. On a kind of nuts and bolts level, I believe in terms of our future as a community, we need to find some ways to extend that kind of a safe zone. We need to find ways to make it a little bit more embracing, a little bit bigger, among other things, partly because, practically speaking, we need to be a little bit bigger to survive. That's not a thing to be blithe about. But it is a thing to be conscious of the strategic parameters of. And partly what I mean by that is that as a leadership team, we've been doing this exercise over the last while where we're thinking about if we were going to try to represent this community to people who aren't part of it, how might we do that? What are some of the characteristics of this community that we want people to be able to sense and see and encounter in how we communicate about ourselves? And James has given us some super helpful questions as he kind of works on, has generously volunteered to kind of work on helping us re-represent ourselves visually, graphically, and some things like that. And as we've been doing our work as a leadership team around this, one of the numbers that kind of keeps bubbling to the top, we think about, and I wrote in my notes, be soft on this, but be passionate about the why behind it. So I want to be soft about the number. This is not a predictive number. This is not a prescriptive number. It's a descriptive number. But as we try to imagine a formed reality for this gathering or this community in particular in the future, we imagine it maybe being about 100 people, 110 right in there. Not much bigger than that. And the reason for that is sociological. The reason for that is that the research says over and over again that when any group gets to be much bigger than that, we don't feel like we know everyone anymore. So right in that range somewhere. And so when I imagine a healthy, thriving gathering of this community, of this type, there's lots of other types of gathering, that's kind of what I imagine. And so in the process of all of that, as a leadership team, we've been kind of going, well, we couldn't fit that in here. And we're vulnerable here and we know it. And in the middle of that conversation, hi, Abby. Thank you for giving shape to our vulnerability in such a concrete and immediate way. And so when we look for a place to gather, that's partly what's kind of perking along in the background. Okay? So just so you guys know. And that's not, that's not meant to be a last word. This is a community that needs to discern these things together. And if you have thoughts about this, you have imaginings about this, you have ideas about what a good space for us would be in which to make a safe place when we gather, then talk to anybody you know that's part of the leadership team. If you don't know who's part of the leadership team, talk to me and I'll tell you who to talk to. And that would be lovely. So that's one way that I think this community can be who we kind of are uniquely shape to be at this point in the story. Community that makes a safe place for big questions and big shifts. And the one other thing that kind of came to me when I was thinking about this question was that I think it might be fair to say that we can be a community, and this might sound so stereotypical as we can just blow it off, but I'll kind of unpack what I mean by it a little bit. Be a community that's growing in its understanding of what caring for one another in both sort of the small and large community sense means. One of the things that I loved about what happened when the people who are operating the Exchange Cafe now said no more candles before we sent in our one-woman negotiating army. That's too violent a metaphor. I just like the power of it, personally. So there you go. Before Lisa went to talk to them about all this, is we said, what about a basin and a towel? What about this image from Jesus with his disciples. And that story, I want us to touch on that story a little bit more, because I think there's a bunch of things in there that are about us and that are about this time in our culture. So this story actually comes to us pretty much exclusively from John's account. John chapter 13. I'm going to read it to us. Listen, I'd say especially to the dialogue. Listen to Jesus trying to describe to the disciples what's really going on in this moment. Just before the Passover feast, Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. You thought that was the cross, didn't you? The full extent of Jesus' love. See how intriguing this story is? John's unapologetic about the depth of what's happening here. This is not the warm-up to the cross. This story has, if you will, a cruciform shape. This is the same love, the full extent of his love. The evening meal was being served, and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So, that's a big setup, right? Don't miss the setup. Who's about to do this? Well, that guy. The guy who is God, who came from God, who's going back to God, who has all power. And so, because that's true, he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, wrapped a towel around his waist, and after that he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" New ick. Jesus replied, "You do not realize now what I am doing, but later you'll understand." "No," said Peter. "You shall never wash my feet." Jesus answered, "Unless I wash you, you have no part with me." "Well then, Lord," Simon Peter replied, "not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well." I love Peter. If a church can be built on somebody that vacillates that wildly, anything can happen. Jesus answered, "A person who has had a bath needs only to wash his feet. His whole body is clean. And you're clean, though not every one of you, for he knew who was going to betray him, and that was why he said not everyone was clean." When he had finished washing their feet, okay, there's so much in this text. Anyway, don't ignore the fact that Jesus is talking with Peter. What's Peter's story hold? Betrayal. There's more than one betrayer in the room. Peter makes a very different choice on the other side of his betrayal of Jesus than Judas does. Do not mistake the Judas story and the Peter story for different stories because they have different endings. All right. That's all I'm going to say about that. Let's keep going. Do you understand? Well, sorry, when he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. "Do you understand what I've done for you?" he asked them. "You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. I tell you the truth, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them." I don't know about you, but I would love to see this community be whatever blessed is. And Jesus is unequivocal in this story about the pathway to that. But here's the thing. Do we get what this story is about? What happens in this story is Jesus does this thing that there is something inside every one of us that is deeply resistant to. And I'm going to sort of say it the way the story says it. He strips down in the presence of his community to serve them in a way that the culture of the day would have clearly understood to be beneath his dignity as a teacher. He's a rabbi. He's an elite in certain ways in this culture. For all that he is not a wealthy person, not a power holder in the religious power structure, he holds a certain kind of authority, a certain kind of dignity in the culture. The people in that culture walked in literal shit in ways that we only walk in it figuratively in our culture. The streets were also the stables. The streets had livestock in them, and it was a culture of sandaled footwear. When you come into the house after walking on those streets, you're not kind of dusty. You're a mess. And having that kind of a mess washed up, well, the most immediate illustration that I can think of is the mess that Miles made this morning that needed to be dealt with. That his father just graciously and confidently took care of. All the rest of us said, "What's that smell?" We make messes. We make messes of our own lives. The lives of people that we love have messes in them. Have debris, smelly stuff, refuse. The picture here, you guys, is of Jesus disregarding whatever that thing is in us that says, isn't there somebody who can take care of the menial work of cleaning up this mess so I can just come along and, I don't know, do the nice part, do some other part, but not that part? Because to do that part, you know what I have to do? I have to kind of strip myself down and walk in there and, like, touch the mess. I have to kind of do the undignified work of being in the mess with this person, with these people. When Jesus does this, John says, he shows his disciples the full extent of his love. I do not anticipate, I could be wrong, but I do not anticipate, nor do I live with any ongoing fear, that one day I will be called upon to literally, concretely, physically stretch out on a cross until I'm dead because I'm a follower of Jesus. I don't really carry a concrete, embodied sense of that being likely around with me. But I could tell you story after story after story of being in situations where I know that I need to walk into the mess and help with it somehow, get messy with it with people somehow. And that if I don't, the full extent of the love that I am shown in Christ, the full extent of the love that I know in the community of faith is not going to be carried forward. And I know that I can't do that and stay tidy and dignified myself. That there is no way to wade into that reality without being vulnerable, exposed, stripped down, and getting dirty myself. And that's what is in my mind and my heart when I think about being a community that's growing in its understanding of what caring for one another means. This is not about getting it right, you guys. It's not about getting it right. It's about learning what it means practically to be willing to strip down to our basic stuff and to wade into the ugly things that we pick up as human beings just walking around in life. Listen to Jesus' words to Peter. Listen to what Jesus says to Peter. He says, if you don't let me do this, you can't get close to me. And then, damn him, he says, now go and do the same thing. Well then,
You mean if we don't wade into other people's messy lives, and this includes spiritually messy and not just externally messy, if we don't let other people do this for us, that we can't get close to God? Well, God's awfully big. I'm not going to say that categorically that's true, but it wouldn't be a crazy thing to have that follow on the way Jesus told this story, would it? One last story, and we're going to carry on. I was out at Camp Cedarwood last week. Brennan Catani, the director out there. Brennan was a camper when I was a director. It's really fun. You really should live in a community long enough to get to have experiences like this. It's awesome. And so he invited me to come out there and spend a day with his leadership team, which was pretty nervy of him. Brennan and I have had enough conversations that we know that we're not on the same page about lots of pretty significant things. And he did that anyway, which moved me really deeply. Made me really grateful. And it occurred to me, though, I don't know how many of you have heard me tell this story, but when I was a director out there, it was on my watch as a director that we burned the lodge to the ground. And so I was thinking about that yesterday night, and I was thinking, why is it that it seems like when I'm responsible for leadership in communities, they lose their buildings? I got over it. But I would like to say something to this community that's akin to what I said to my team the day we were sitting on the front lawn watching the lodge burn to the ground, only days before summer camp was supposed to start. What I said to them then, and what I say to us now, is now we'll find out if we really mean it about what we say matters most. The most significant, the most rooted things in our lives are things that can travel with us, that can be translated into different settings. And the best examples that I know of that truth are these big biblical stories, which is why we keep poking around in them, and in what it means to do the work of translators into a culture and a time that is ours. Say, what does that story mean here? What does that story mean now? In fact, I think that we can look forward with curiosity and with hopeful expectation to what the work is that God has for us to do going forward. And I think that the kind of transition that we're headed into, watch the website, pay attention to your email inbox so you have some idea where we're gathering. I think the kind of transition that we're headed into can call out the best of what we might be as a community. I don't think this is a thing to fear at all. It may have some fearsome components to it, but not a thing to live with any kind of dread about. A bit of sadness would be appropriate. This has been a lovely home for us, I think, in so many ways. There's good memories here. There's a couple of boxes of things, like Megan's story this morning, that we'll take with us, that are dear to us, and we'll carry to our next home, put in that space to remind us of who we are. But I think that the world is full of people that are dying for what we get to enjoy here, for a place where people that are willing to just bring their basic unadorned selves into the messiness of others' everyday lives, people that are willing to serve in loving and humble ways. I think we're dying for it. I think we get to do it and be it, however and wherever that happens. And when we do, our sacred text says that what happens is that God comes close to us. And that's awesome.